Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Soundcheck Podcast listeners, John here. Do you have a blind spot in your musical knowledge? Have you ever wanted to be smarter about a particular kind of music or a particular musician? We want your suggestions for our upcoming project called How to Be Smarter About... ... Tell us what music you want to be smarter about. You can email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org, or leave a message at 866-939-1612. That's soundcheck@wnyc.org or 866-939-1612. From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Beth Orton's music career took off when she worked with electronica artists like William Orbit and the Chemical Brothers back in the 90s. But since then, she's moved further and further from that sound toward the acoustic folk music that she's doing today.
Once I'd learned my craft, I was like, oh, sod that, you know, I'm just going to do what I want.
Coming up, we'll hear more from Beth Orton's 2013 appearance on Soundcheck when she played songs from her album Sugaring Season, one of our favorite albums of 2013. But let's start with the acclaimed British producer, Joe Boyd. Now, if you haven't heard of him, Joe Boyd has had a big hand in launching some major careers, especially on the other side of the Atlantic. He produced Pink Floyd's first single, Arnold Lane.
Arnold Lane had a strange...
and all of the early albums by The Incredible String Band and Fairport Convention. He's also worked with artists like Eric Clapton, Richard Thompson, and Billy Bragg, just to name a few. We can also credit Joe Boyd with discovering the English singer-songwriter Nick Drake and producing his first records. Although those records didn't take off during Nick Drake's lifetime, since his death in 1974, Drake's legend has grown and he's become hugely influential. Back in 2013, Joe Boyd put together a tribute album called Way to Blue, The Songs of Nick Drake. And when he joined us to talk about it, I started by asking him to give us a quick summary of who Nick Drake was.
Nick Drake was a upper middle class, well-educated English boy who developed a very unique style of guitar playing, who wrote very sophisticated songs which were very difficult to categorize. He was very shy. He failed to connect with the few audiences that he confronted. He took a long time tuning his guitar to very complicated tunings. And as a result of which, the records that I made with him didn't sell. And he was very depressed about this. He felt very isolated. He grew more isolated as he grew older and eventually died of an overdose of antidepressants in 1974. And in the subsequent years, starting around 1977, 78, various people started writing about these records and a kind of groundswell of interest built up. And from, I'd say, 78 to 98, every year we sold more and more and more and more
than the year before. Yeah.
And eventually there was a Volkswagen commercial.
Right. And I remember being in the kitchen and my wife had the TV on in the other room, and suddenly I heard Pink Moon and I came running in. I was like, what are you watching? And there it was, a Volkswagen commercial with this song by Nick Drake.
I saw it written and I saw it say, Pink Moon is on its way. None of you stand so tall. Pink Moon, then I get you. Thank you.
That's the title track from Nick Drake's 1972 album, Pink Moon. And my guest here is Joe Boyd in the Soundcheck studio, who produced Nick's first couple of records. Joe, you mentioned that Nick Drake had trouble connecting to an audience. Something somewhere along the line connected with you. Where, when did you first hear Nick Drake, and what was it that made you think, I need to work with this guy?
Fairport Convention played on the same gig that he was on.
And the English folk rock band.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the bass player, Ashley Hutchings, heard Nick and was intrigued and went and got his phone number and brought the phone number to me in my office and just handed me the slip of paper, said, you better call this guy. He's pretty interesting. And I called him. He brought in a tape. He left. At the end of the day, I put the tape on a little Wallenzach recorder in the corner of my office, and there were four songs on the tape, and I played the tape once, I played the tape twice, I played the tape three times. I just was stunned by it. Mm-hmm. And I called him up. I said, let's come on in, let's talk.
Wow. And it was just, was it as simple as that?
Yeah, he was so unlike anyone else, and the music was so sophisticated, the words were so cleverly crafted. Yeah. The thing, it was just another level to me, for me, of what you heard from your average singer-songwriter in 1969, you know.
So how frustrating was it for you to know that you're working with this guy who has this absolutely, you know, unique way of writing songs, tuning the guitar, this great voice, and it's just not connecting. It's just not going over.
I know. It was such a shock, because I had this, I think I was probably a bit overconfident. I thought, well, Leonard Cohen doesn't sing live. You know, he thought, I'm a poet, I'm not a singer in those days. And he sold 100,000 records of his first album. I said, well, if he can do it, Nick Drake can do it. And I thought, we'd done a great record, the first record. And in later years, I read, somebody sent me a review from Melody Maker, of Five Leaves Left, and it said that Five Leaves Left was an awkward mixture of folk and cocktail jazz.
Mm. Wow.
So people just didn't get it. And you can sort of, in a way, I mean, it's terrible to think about this way, but the truth is, in a way, the fact that it didn't connect with the 60s, and the early 70s, has sort of freed the music to be appropriated by each subsequent generation. It's not something that was in those kids' parents' record collection. You don't hear Nick Drake songs in soundtracks to documentaries about the 60s.
Right.
It sort of frees. It floats freely in time.
So it's not sort of stuck in amber. It's not, you know, as a relic of something from those days. Five Leaves Left was the first record, 1969. Yep. And then you did
Brighter Later.
Yep. Which was the second record. Speaking with Joe Boyd, and now there's Way to Blue, the songs of Nick Drake, which is this tribute album. So you waited a long time to do this.
Well, you know, the whole idea of doing tribute albums, I've never been huge enthusiast for that, because largely they don't work very well. Most tribute albums, people do their tracks and they send them in and then you put them all together. And the albums never hang together. They never sell particularly. Hmm. And the whole idea I've been slightly resistant to. But I was asked to put together a concert in Birmingham 4 years ago.
In Birmingham, England,
yeah. And I kind of had fun working with Kate St. John, who's a wonderful musical director, and Robert Kirby, who had written the original arrangements for Nick. And the three of us got together and we planned this concert and we had a great time doing it. And I remember feeling at the time, I don't want to record this. I don't want to get in talking to managers about rights and, you know, whatever. I don't want the artist to feel like it's being recorded. It's just a moment in time. It's going to evaporate. You have to be there. And it was just great. And the audiences loved it. And we got an offer to do more concerts. And then little by little, the band and the singers got so good at it that I thought, this might actually be worth releasing.
So then you had to talk to lawyers and managers.
Exactly.
And stuff. among the people on the record, you've got Lisa Hannigan,
the Irish singer and cellist who some of us will remember from her work with Damien Rice. She does a couple of songs. Let's hear her version of Nick Drake's Black Eyed Dog.
A black eyed dog in your mind and leg. Black eyed dog. A black eyed dog. I'm growing old and I wanna go home. I'm growing old and I don't wanna know. I'm growing
a little bit of Nick Drake's Black Eyed Dog, sung by Lisa Hannigan and taken from the album Way to Blue, the songs of Nick Drake, featuring people like Greene Gartside and Robin Hitchcock, Vashti Bunyan, Teddy Thompson, lots of others. Produced by Joe Boyd, who produced so many of the classic records of the 60s and 70s, Fairport Convention, who we mentioned before, of course, Nick Drake's first couple of records, Joe. Did you know his mom?
I did.
Molly Drake having a moment recently.
Absolutely, and about time. Whenever I met her, I went to their house a few times, and there was a piano in the front room, and there was always like music papers scattered around, and Molly once said to me, oh, well, you know, I just write a few amateur things, you know, I just fool around. And Nick used to say, well, yes, my mom writes a few things, you know, very dismissive. And it wasn't until after Nick and Molly were both dead that Gabrielle, Nick's sister, gave me a cassette of recordings of Molly's songs. And I put this cassette on and I was absolutely stunned because you can hear in those chords, you can hear a lot of the unusual shapes of chords that Nick used.
Mm.
And in a way, you sort of feel, I mean, it's a bit of an oversimplification, but the reason that Nick had such complicated tunings was in order to match the sound that his mother got on the piano when he was growing up at home.
Yeah.
And
so it's the missing link in the Nick Drake
in a way.
Origin story.
The other Nick missing link, which I've come to in later years, which I deeply regret I never talked to Nick about, I think, if the more you listen, the more I feel, João Gilberto.
Oh.
That if you
the
know,
Brazilian singer-songwriter,
that the whole relationship between the way the vocal line and the guitar parts being so different, and going in such different directions, and you hear the beginning of "Poor Boy" is such a bossa nova beginning, you know. And I think you hear it subtly in a lot of Nick's music. And he was very open-eared. He listened to Miles Davis. He listened to Django Reinhardt. He listened to a wide range of influences, and I'm sure he must have heard bossa nova.
And the influence of his mother might not even have been noticed by either of them with her stuff just being in the house there. But now there is this record by Nick Drake's mother, the late Molly Drake, which includes this song called How Wild the Wind Blows.
The acorn carries an oak tree sleeping, but for a little while winter lies in the arms of spring. As a mother carries her child and never knows how wild the wind blows. A thought carries a universe, a seed carries a field of grain. Love lies in the arms of change. As a joy carries a pain, and no one knows.
How Wild the Wind Blows, a song, amateur recording, obviously, Molly Drake, Nick Drake's mother, also now deceased. We're speaking with Joe Boyd, who has put together the tribute album to Nick Drake called Way to Blue. Your work with Nick Drake, does it threaten to sort of overshadow all of the many other things that you've done during a very long and productive career?
No. I mean, I'm never going to be bashful about my work with Nick because I'm very proud of it. But, you know, I get rung up by the BBC to talk about lots of subjects. Recently, I've been doing an awful lot of talking about Sid Barrett. There have been a number of...
The founder of Pink Floyd.
Yeah, because I worked with him for a bit. And
how did that happen? How did a young American teenager in England end up being such a central part of the blossoming psychedelic rock scene, the folk rock scene?
I don't know. I mean, you know, you just put one foot in front of the other and things happen, and it's only you conceptualize it only when you look backwards. But I think that in trying to get some perspective on it, I suppose that being an outsider, there was a little bit of an advantage, or at least a different perspective on, you know, to me, you know, Sid Barrett, Robin Williamson, Mike Heron, Nick
from the
Drake,
Incredible String
yeah,
Band,
Richard Thompson, Sandy Denny. They were all just talents that I saw as an outsider. I didn't have a kind of insider's obsession with being part of the pop scene or being part of the folk scene or being part of the underground scene or the jazz scene or whatever. To me, it was just all, wow, these are great talents, you know. And so maybe that was a help.
Yeah. And so you end up producing, which, you know, that role as a producer was sort of evolving at that time.
Yeah. But it was interesting. I read a book when I was a teenager called The Country Blues by Sam Charters.
Oh, yeah.
And he talked about Ralph Peer going through the South, renting hotel ballrooms and dragging the Memphis Jug Band and then later Jimmy Rogers and the Carter Family in to make records. And I thought, wow, I wish I'd been born in those days. I wish I'd been alive then. I would have loved to do that, you know. And then I had this revelation when I was about 17, you know, that the pop music of today is just a continuity of all of that. And it sort of hit me like, wow, I could do that.
Mm.
And actually, I was standing in the outfield catching fly balls for the starting nine at my high school team, and I was becoming clear that I was never going to be more than a second stringer. And I had this revelation. I listened to a Fats Domino record floating across the field, and I thought, yeah, it was Walking to New Orleans. And I realized that he was from New Orleans, and he was part of this New Orleans jazz that I loved, and it was just a continuity. And I thought, yes, and I could be a record producer, and all the first nine will be jealous.
So you put down your mitt and you haven't played baseball since.
That's
moved
right.
to a country where they don't even know from baseball.
That's right. They call it rounders.
We're speaking with Joe Boyd. So working with someone like Sid Barrett and the original Pink Floyd, though, it wasn't as simple as renting a room, putting them in, throwing up mics, making a record. I mean, listen to Arnold Lane, and there's lots of layers of stuff going on here. I mean, producing was a creative process at this point.
Yeah, but I mean, we were just trying to recreate in the studio what the Floyd sounded like. When I had a club called the UFO Club where they played, so I was very familiar with, and we had to compress these 12-minute excursions that they did into 3 minutes. And I was very fortunate because I stumbled across a studio called Sound Techniques and an engineer called John Wood, and I learned a huge amount from him. He knew nothing about this kind of music that I was bringing in, but I knew very little about sound. But I'd also had wonderful mentors. I mean, I sat next to Paul Rothchild in the studio in New York before I went to England when he was working with – he was the guy who produced the Butterfield Blues Band and Janis Joplin and the Doors. You know, Paul was one of the great producers of the 60s, and he sadly died quite young of cancer. I think Strange Days by the Doors is one of the great sounding records of that era, and that was Paul.
Well, and this was Joe Boyd, Pink Floyd's Arnold Lane.
Arnold Lane had a strange hobby.
Song is Arnold Lane. It was an early hit for Pink Floyd at the time when Syd Barrett was still leading the band. And Joe Boyd, my guest, producing early Pink Floyd. And that's still a great sound.
it's a wonderful song, too. And it wasn't until years later I learned from other members of the group that Syd had grown up with his mother owned, and they had extra rooms, and they used to rent to students. And she discovered very early on that boys were annoying as tenants, that they were messy, that they didn't pay the rent on time. So she always rented to girls. And this was before washers and dryers, automatic, whatever, so that there was very often in the backyard hanging on the line, there was girls' underwear. And he remembers girls saying, "I left 5 knickers out to dry. There's only 4 now. Where'd the other one go?" And then there was a story in the local paper about a guy who got convicted of panty sniffing. And there, hence you have a folk song, which David Bowie actually said, he was quoted as saying that Arnold Lane changed his life. It gave him the freedom to sing just as he talked. Mm. That here was Syd singing not like an American, not like he was black, not like trying to be something he wasn't, just singing the way he talked. And this was greatly liberating for Bowie.
Now, it's, we were talking about your work with Nick Drake before, and of course, Nick Drake died at the age of 26. Syd Barrett, after whatever happened to him that famous weekend, the psychedelic meltdown, and out of Pink Floyd, and then living in his mother's house for all those years, and I mean, were you in touch with him during those later years?
No. It was very frustrating. I mean, I made that record. The group got a deal with EMI as a result of that record. They put it out. It was a hit. But EMI was a very rigid, old-school company. They wanted everything to be made in their studios with their producers, their staff engineers, their staff producers. And so I was let go. Mm-hmm. And so I saw him. He came down to play at UFO, but he deteriorated over the course of those months afterwards. And then it was just he just went off. It was very uncomfortable and painful to be around him because I remembered the great, sparky, bright-eyed, mm-hmm. wonderful, smart guy that I'd met.
Yeah. You were so busy in those days. I mean, you mentioned, Fairport Convention, Richard Thompson and Sandy Denny. Of course, Richard Thompson and Linda Thompson, and now the next generation, Teddy Thompson's on the Nick Drake tribute. So obviously those are ties that you've maintained over the long years.
Absolutely.
And what about the McGarrigles, Kate and Anna?
Well, that was doing the first two records of Kate and Anna was a great experience for me. And Kate McGarrigle was, a dear friend for all her life and a wonderful character. And I think one of the great North American songwriters. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say American because she's Canadian.
Canadian, right.
At one level, it's a bit depressing to think that I'm, my work with these people, some are now in the category of tribute concerts. But the concert we did a couple of years ago at Town Hall, we did 2 nights at Town Hall. Before that, we did the Festival Hall in England. Then we did Toronto last summer. They've been wonderful concerts because you have so many different singers, different styles, very much the same with Nick. You get people who sound so different from Nick singing these songs, so different from Kate singing her songs. And to me, that contrast proves what great songs they are.
Mm.
And we had, everyone from, her kids, Rufus and Martha to Nora Jones and Jimmy Fallon and Anthony, singing her songs. And they just stand up as wonderful, brilliant songs.
Joe Boyd has been my guest on Soundcheck. The new album is called Way to Blue, The Songs of Nick Drake. And we'll hear We'll hear a version of Riverman done by Teddy Thompson, the son of Richard and Linda Thompson, with whom Joe has worked so productively over the years. Joe, great to have you with us on Soundcheck today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Betty said she prayed today for the sky to blow away, or maybe stay. She wasn't sure.
To dive even deeper into the story of Nick Drake, check out soundcheck.org for an online feature about the singer-songwriter's biggest influence, his mother, Molly Drake. Some of her previously unheard recordings were recently released, and you can hear one of them online at soundcheck.org. Coming up next, English singer-songwriter Beth Orton joins us here in the studio to play songs from her most recent album, Sugaring Season. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the background, you're hearing a song called Magpie. It's the lead-off track from the latest album by the English singer-songwriter Beth Orton. I sat down with Beth to talk about that album called Sugaring Season in a conversation that ranged from poetry to electronic music. But first, she started us off with a song. Together with her husband, the singer-songwriter Sam Amidon, and the keyboardist Thomas Bartlett, a.k.a. Doveman, the group started off with Beth Orton's Dawn Chorus, live on Soundcheck.
Dawn breeze brushed my cheek and I knew what I had to leave. Dawn chorus came and glorious all wrapped up in your sheets. Beneath the noise, there's always silence. And what has left is ours to surprise us. And you could claim it, you could claim it, you could claim it, it was unknown. This would be going. All the stories people tell, and all the tales I have from myself. It's best you know what else gets told. The soft flesh that beats neath your breast. Beneath my nose, there's always silence. And what is left comes on to surprise us. And I could swear, I could swear, I could swear that it was unknown. I never knew, no, I had a clue, no, I never knew where this would be going. The sun to come by. I wait and wait and wait and wait, but never seem to share the same sky. Beneath the noise, there's always silence. And what is left comes on to surprise us. And I can swear it, I can swear it, I can claim that it was my knowing. I'm in the new, no, I had a clue, no, I never knew where this would be going. Ba-da-ba-ba-da-da-ba-ba-da.
That is Beth Orton live on Soundcheck with her song Dawn Chorus. It appears on her last album called Sugaring Season. Beth Orton singing and playing guitar. Welcome to Soundcheck, Beth.
Thank you.
And a couple of familiar faces, Sam Amidon playing guitar, Thomas Bartlett at our piano. Both of those guys, Beth, will know what sugaring season means. How does an English girl come to know that term?
Well, I heard it when I was hanging out with Sam in Vermont, and people were just banding it about willy-nilly, and I was like, hang on a minute, you know, and it just popped into my head and into my consciousness, and then I wrote a song with that in the sort of in the whatever, and then I was like, hang on a minute, that would be a beautiful title for this record, because it's, you know, talks about the seasons and so on and so forth. It just seemed like a very romantic term to me.
So I mean, it's literally when the sap rises in the maple trees,
mm-hmm.
and
gets
that's when you tap the tree and make the sugar.
And the more I found out about it, the more I was like, oh my goodness, everything, you know, it comes out kind of a bit bitter, and you have to make the sweetness, and you have to kind of like, you know, it's like, oh, it's so on every level. It just seemed to be very kind of fitting for a title for a record and making music and so on.
So the Sugaring Season, your first album in 6 years. People have talked about the kind of the nature imagery, and you've already mentioned the seasons. It struck me as a very autumnal record. And I don't mean just because there's that track Last Leaves of Autumn. Just in general, that's the season that kind of...
Definitely.
Was that an intent, or did it just happen that way?
I think it's definitely one of my favorite seasons. It's very evocative, that time of year. It just, you know... It always brings about so many feelings. I don't know. So yeah, if that came out, that would make sense.
Yeah. So in the intervening years between your last record and Sugaring Season, you've married Sam, you've had a couple of kids, and you studied with the late Bert Jansch, who was an amazing guitar player.
Yeah.
Is he somebody? I mean, growing up, did you listen to Pentangle, to Bert's solo stuff?
I mean, growing up, when I was a kid, my mom worked at this art center, and so I would see a lot of people coming through. He was one of the people who used to come through, and I had it in my mind, like, oh, he'd be a good person. And when I made Trailer Park, I wanted him to be the guitarist, so I used to follow him around and appear at, like, turn up at the 12 Bar Blues Club and, like, but come in the wrong door and like land on the stage and be like, oh, shame. And then turn up at like the garage. He was playing there one time and then he just disappeared. And yeah, I sort of lost that dream. And then eventually I ended up being on the same bill as Bert. And he was lovely. And him and his wife, Lauren, invited me over for tea and biscuits, which is what they do a lot of, drinking tea and biscuits, or what they did a lot of. And I asked him for guitar lessons.
So now you're an ace guitarist.
No, I'm not. I'm not. Don't laugh. I'm not an ace guitarist, but I'm a
Is that your husband laughing at
yes.
you?
Tell them about what you said to the girls. Beth just went by the girls rock and roll camp.
Oh, the rock
downtown.
The rock camp for girls.
Yeah, yes.
Willie May.
It was amazing.
And she gave them some wise songwriting
What did I
words.
Say? My wise songwriting words.
About the two
what
chords and everything.
Oh, yeah. I was like, you know, don't be ashamed of your limitations. Your limitations are your strengths. And if you can only write a song on two chords, as so can I, you know, that's a great thing. And, mm-hmm. and all the best songwriters, you know, I can't read music or anything like that. And I didn't work with Bert to become like an ace guitarist, but I just sort of asked him, and then this whole other scenario happened. It was really...
But you did get a lot into the tunings a lot with him.
I got into tunings.
By tunings, you mean alternate tunings, open string tunings, mm-hmm. which Bert played a lot of.
Yeah.
Soundcheck listeners, Bert Jansch, not too long before his death, performed here in our Soundcheck studio and did his best-known song, Black Waterside. You should check it out on our website. You can find it. Look up J-A-N-S-C-H. When the mics went off, he turned to me and he said, I've been playing that song for 40 years. It might be the best performance I've ever done.
Good old Beth.
So, yeah, you gotta check it out. It's great.
Beth
Orton's here with us in the Soundcheck studio today. One of the reasons I asked the question about studying the guitar is, you know, very often songwriting, the process will be affected by the instrument you choose to play on. When you're dealing with open tunings, that will lead you in some places as opposed to others. Did you find that you've started writing songs differently from the way you used to?
Yeah, maybe. I've started reinterpreting my old songs differently than I used to. And yeah, everything changes. I would say the biggest impact on my songwriting has been having kids. You know, that certainly changes you and puts you through the kind of some kind of machine that could come out the other end and you're not the same. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, it's good. But it changes everything.
It changes everything.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so that's been a huge effect. But everything changes and nothing changes. You know, it's one of those. And I think, though, I mean, I never know how to pinpoint the changes, but I feel them. And someone said to me the other day that it's really good when you can't actually put something into words, because as soon as you put it into words, you've boxed it, you've put it away, it's filed under described. And actually, it's good not to often know how to describe something, because you give it a freedom then.
That's well said.
Thanks.
So let's hear an old song from Beth Orton called Galaxy of Emptiness. Thomas Bartlett at and inside our piano, and Sam Amidon playing the violin. They're playing for us live on Soundcheck.
Stars light the sky and a galaxy of emptiness tonight. Oh, I'm happiest when there's no reason for me to be. With no one's expectation to weigh heavy on my heart. So much hope it sometimes tears me all apart. Could you please knock me off my feet for a while? Could you please knock me off my feet for a while? Sky and a gutter full of broken dreams tonight. No, I'm not content, that's the way it seems to be. Still, I've been fighting all week, though I don't know who for. I'm hoping someone else somewhere near knows the score. Could you please knock me off my feet for a while? Could you please knock me off my feet for a while? Well, there's this galaxy. Oh, a galaxy of emptiness tonight. Yeah, there's this galaxy of emptiness. Oh, a galaxy of emptiness. Spend my whole life surrounded by people like you. with all that expectation too heavy on your heart, and no idea what lay a tear it all apart. Could you please knock me off my feet for a while? Could you please knock me off my feet for a while, while there's this galaxy of emptiness tonight? Oh, a galaxy of emptiness tonight. Yeah, there's this galaxy of emptiness. Oh, a galaxy of empty. And I'm gonna burn to fire, and I'm turning to fire, and I'm burning to fire. I'm gonna turn to find, it's all to find, it's all to find now, it's all to find now. It's all to find now.
That is a great arrangement of an early Beth Orton song called Galaxy of Emptiness. From an old song to one of the newer ones, let's go back to the new record Sugaring Season for this next performance. The song's called Call Me the Breeze. Beth Orton, live on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
Call Me the Breeze. You'll find that on Beth Orton's latest record called Sugaring Season, but that's a live performance with Sam Amidon and Thomas Bartlett here in the Soundcheck studio. At this point, Beth, you're used to being unplugged after spending the 90s, as you say, working with dance producers, William Orbit, the Chemical Brothers, Fortet, you know, some pretty great electronic people. Do you feel any tug of that world, any pull to maybe try and get back into that in some way?
I don't really want to try and get back into it, but, like, it's never left me, and it's always in my mind as, like, you know, that's how I got into making music. And like I say, I sort of felt like I needed to learn my craft. And then once I'd learned my craft, I was like, oh, sod that. You know, I'm just going to do what I want. I mean, I just want to feel liberated when I make music. So I don't feel like I need to be attached. And I like that. I think when I started making music, I didn't know what I was doing, and I just looked to do whatever felt free and didn't feel like, you know, because I have a issue with folk music. I always have, like, with sort of Sam style of thing. Like, No, but I love it.
I sense an episode of Dr. Phil breaking out here.
What's Dr. Phil? Oh, is that like, okay, we're going to talk about our relationship. That's counseling. Good. So anyway, when I was 12, no. So it's good. It's good. What I'm basically saying is I'm open.
Okay.
You know.
All right. Sugaring Season is the latest from Beth Orton. It's a terrific record, Beth. Thanks so much for playing some of it for us today.
Thank you.
My wrath did end. I was angry with my father. I told him not my wrath did grow. And I watered it with fear. Night and morning with my tears. Smiles and with soft, deceitful wiles.
Up next, find out why one of the best-known songs from the British band Squeeze failed miserably on the charts. That's coming up next on Soundcheck.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks...
That was a hit.
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Joining us for this week's edition of That Was a Hit is music writer and NPR music contributor Chris Malanfi. Chris, welcome back. Not your first time on this series.
Right.
But at your request or at your suggestion, we're turning the series on its head and calling it That Wasn't a Hit?
Right.
Why are we doing this?
When friends come over to my apartment and they look at my shelf of Billboard books that can list every hit they've ever had, the first thing they do is they pull a book off the shelf and they look up their favorite artist, and a good percentage of the time they go, wait a minute, how is this not a hit? You know, they'll flip to the page where the Pixies should be or the Smiths and say, the Smiths never had a Hot 100 hit. That's insane, you know. So I find that just as much of the time as people are marveling that these bizarre songs were hits, they're also marveling that these unbelievably catchy, wonderful songs that we consider gold now were not hits, often for bizarre reasons or inexplicable reasons. So I thought we should do the flip side of That Was a Hit.
Okay, so this wasn't a hit. What this are we talking about?
Well, we could have started with many different types of songs, but the one that I always bring up because it boggles my mind because it's such a catchy song is Tempted by Squeeze.
That song was everywhere.
You'd think that. Tempted by Squeeze, it's from their fourth album, East Side Story, famously an album produced by Elvis Costello. Elvis Costello actually sings a line in the song. It's a piece of blue-eyed soul, so it was a bit of a change-up for the band. They were, you know, a post-punk / new wave band.
Mm-hmm. From England.
From England, fronted by the, you know, new Lennon-McCartney of Glenn Tilbrook and Chris Difford. They wrote a string of very catchy songs. They'd yet to break the charts in America, and they did actually break the Hot 100 with this song, but it peaked at an incredibly modest number 49.
Wow, so it didn't hit the top 40.
It didn't make the top 40. And it's their first American hit of any kind, which is also mind-blowing when you consider how many unbelievably catchy songs they had. I often say to people, the reason MTV had to come along and create the second British Invasion was because there was just such a wave of great British, not just rock, but pop, catchy songs. And these songs were not hits here. And Tempted is a signal example of that. This should have been a massive hit.
I can't believe it wasn't. I guess that's kind of the point.
Right.
The song is Tempted from 1981 by the band Squeeze.
I'm at the car park, the airport, the baggage carousel.
The people keep on crying,
being wishing I was well.
I said it's no occasion,
it's no story.
My bedside, empty pocket, a foot without a sock. Your body gets much closer, I fumble for the clock. Along by the seduction, I wish that it would stop. Tempted by the fruit of another, tempted but the truth is discovered.
The song is Tempted by the band Squeeze, and it was not a hit in 1981. Chris Melanfi with us on Soundcheck and turning our series That Was a Hit upside down with a song that feels like a hit, sounds like a hit. I thought it was a hit. Why didn't it break the top 40?
It's anyone's guess. I mean, you know, you normally when a song like this isn't a hit in America, if you're an Anglophile pop fan like I am, you stick your nose up in the air and sniff. Well, at least the British have better taste than we do. It wasn't a hit in England either. It peaked at number 41 in England, which makes no sense. And by then, Squeeze had hits in England like Take Me, I'm Yours. You know,
the whole album Cool for Cats was just one catchy song.
One catchy song, Cool for Cats, was a hit. Up the Junction was a number two hit.
Yeah.
They'd had hits in England. For some reason, the British didn't cotton on to this either. I think it's in part it's because it was a change-up. This was the first and pretty much only album where the vocalist, the Blue-Eyed Soul vocalist, Paul Carrack, sings lead. Paul Carrack is a strange character. He's basically sung on a slew of good pop records, and he rarely stays with a band very long. In the 70s, he had a huge hit here in America called How Long with the band Ace, and that reached number three on our charts. Later in the mid-80s, he joined Mike Rutherford of the band Genesis in a band called Mike and the Mechanics. They had a top 10 hit with him singing lead called Silent Running. Later, they had a number one hit with him singing lead called The Living Years. So Paul Carrack has had hits. Bizarrely, this song, which I would argue is better than any of the ones I've just ticked off, is the least of them on the charts, either here or in England.
And produced by Elvis Costello, who heard singing one of the lines in that verse.
The people keep on crying.
Yeah.
Yeah, that line is Elvis.
And he wouldn't have a top 40 hit for another couple of years either.
That's correct. I mean, yet again, another artist, you know, a great British artist who needed to break in America. His first top 40 hit in America was Every Day I Write the Book in 1983, which finally broke him into the top 40. Not very high. I think it made the mid-30s.
Mm.
He didn't even get into the top 20, I believe, until Veronica in the late 80s. So it took Elvis a while to break, too.
Is it all in that pretty little head of yours? What goes on in that place in the dark? I used to know a girl, and I could have sworn that her name was Veronica. Well, she used to have a carefree mind of her own and a delicate look in her eye. These days, I'm afraid she's not even sure if her name was Veronica.
So, if we're talking about Squeeze and Tempted and how that wasn't a hit,
right?
At what point does Squeeze actually get a genuine top 40 hit?
Here in America, they got it finally in 1987 with a song that is largely forgotten. It's a strange little ditty called Hourglass. It's not that strange, but it's strange that this is their breakthrough hit. It made our top 20. And it's pretty catchy. It's kind of a brain virus, if you will, where Difford and Tilbrook are singing these incredibly fast lines. This is an insult. I don't mean it to sound this ridiculous, but it's kind of like One Week by Bare Naked Ladies, 12 years before One Week. They're singing this chorus that goes, take it to the bridge, throw it overboard, see if it can swim, back up to the shore. And that was their breakthrough in America, pretty much toward the end of their fruitful period.
Yeah.
But yeah, all the great Squeeze songs, Black Coffee in Bed, Annie Get Your Gun, pulling muscles from a shell. None of them were top 40 hits here.
Wow. Hourglass was, but as Chris Melanfi tells us, it was no tempted. Chris, thank you for taking our series and wringing the juices out of it and turning it into something else.
My pleasure.
Chris Melanfi with us on Soundcheck. We're always interested to hear your feedback about this or any other episode of Soundcheck. You can leave us a message at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Or send us an email, soundcheck@wnyc.org. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff with Amy Pearl. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. See you next time. This is Soundcheck.